Hi, welcome to VLectures. I am Ajay Prabhu, a senior banker having 27 years of experience in various segments of banking, including both nationalized banks and private sector banks. I have worked in every part of the banking, take it rural banking, urban banking, metro banking, and in semi-urban banking also. I have conducted various training programs across the country on banking and finance, corporate skills, and communication skills. Today we are going to take lessons in banking fundamentals. Banking system is continuously evolving. Like, if we consider banking in the ancient ages, we did not have anything called banking. There, typically, there was exchange of goods happening. There was a time when banking was restricted only to the elite category. It was not available for the common man. Subsequently, banks have become an integral part of our life. We are so used to banks that we cannot imagine our lives without banks. Banking fundamentals lays bare to you the evolution of banking system from the time it evolved to the present day. Like banking has evolved from the ancient ages to the present day, there are different banking terminologies also that has evolved over a period of time. We have a specific meaning for the word bank. Banker, customer, and people generally quite call it glibly without understanding or realizing what they actually mean. With the growth of modern banking involving complexity of banking transactions, the common terms are well defined in various laws. Hence, it becomes very imperative that one is aware of what they mean under the law. The purpose of study of banking fundamentals for us today would be to understand how the banking has evolved over a period of time. Understand the familiar banking terminology, increase the awareness about the role of banks towards economic development and growth. Realize your duty as a banker. Realize your rights as a banker and obligations towards your customers too. Gone are the days when people just did banking where the goods were exchanged. Now, for any wrong act or any deficiency of service, you can be pulled in the court. So as a banker, you need to be aware about each and every details of the law. The plan of action for today is covering your entire book on banking fundamentals. Banking fundamentals contains 18 chapters, starting from the history of banking to the customer service. We are going to cover each one of them in a more constructive and practical manner. Sometimes when you read the book, there are some doubts that comes to your mind, and I'll be taking care of most of them while we are actually covering our lessons. I'm sure you all are ready. Let us begin with the first chapter, History of Banking. History of Banking explains the manner by which banking evolved from the barter to the present day. But let us understand, where did the word bank come from? There is a lot of difference between the meaning of the word bank and its actual relevance in our day-to-day life. Banking activities in the ancient times were done in different places at different times. The earliest bankers, the Jews and the Italians of Lombard, transacted their banking business on benches in the marketplace and later in the inns. Later in the inns, coffee house, and taverns. Italian word banco, which means bench, it also means in Latin, or in Latin it is called bankers, which also means bench. These ancient bankers used to do exchange of money on these benches. Subsequently, in Germany, a word called back, which means a joint stock fund. Later, it was called blank, bank, B-N-K. And then it was Italianized by Italians into banco, and finally anglicized into the word bank. That is what we all know today. There are some interesting facts about the word bank. In ancient days, if a banker fails in his promise of returning the money, his benches were broken, and that's how he was called bankrupt. The banking place of early bankers were known by the signs, such as we had seen in the last screen. Banking was also done in inns, coffee houses and taverns. Hence, the banks that emerged had the same signs to signify their origin. Barclays Bank, if we see, Barclays Bank has its sign as a black eagle. Presumably, it began its business at an inn called a Black Eagle. Now, before we understand what banking means, we have to understand what money means. Because banking has evolved as a system of exchange of goods and services. Why these goods and services are exchanged? Because it had some value. Every object had a value based on the basis of which it was exchanged. Money is a human contrivance. The society adopted the object of value from one fixed material to another for payments of goods and services and repayment of debts. Money has evolved over the centuries. Over the centuries, money has also evolved. Yes, money has also evolved. The term money is derived from the temple of Juno Monito, which was used by the Romans as a mint of their coins. The earliest form of money was the bones, human bones, on which the marks were made to distinguish between different values. After the bones, as humans got civilized, they found the same object of value in the metals like gold, silver, and bronze. Hence, the metals were started being used as money. Money plays this role within the realm of reciprocal exchange. Every exchange requires money. Money was created, or rather born, to reduce the value of items to a common denominator, to facilitate the exchange of products to satisfy the needs. What does that mean? It simply means you require a common denominator to facilitate exchange of products to satisfy your needs. I want something, so I have to give something. Similarly, the fisherman would sell his fish, as would the farmer, for money. But exactly what is this money is? There are different stages of economic civilization in which money kept on changing based on the civilization of a human being, based on its importance given in the society. We can break up this civilization into five different methods, starting with the barter trade. Then we move on to understand what is a commodity money. Then we understand what is a symbolic money, credit money, and finally the credit clearing. Barter trade, we have studied this in our school books. Barter simply means exchange of goods and services in a marketplace. It did not have any specific value attached. I have something as surplus, which can be in the form of grains, livestock, etc., and could be directly exchanged for something perceived to have similar or greater value. Something perceived to have similar or greater value. But the basic problem here is it depends on the coincidence of wants. For example, if Ramesh wants something from Suresh but has nothing that Suresh wants, how can barter happen? There can be no barter if Suresh or one of the party does not have any need. This was a basic drawback. Hence, capacity to transact was limited in a barter system. There came the first evolutionary step. From barter trade, people moved on to commodity money. Basically, the coincidence of wants and needs and the gap in both space and time needs to be eliminated. How was this possible? It was possible by enabling needs to be met wherever and whenever the needed goods or services may be found. That's how we moved to the commodity money. Commodity money is some useful commodity that is in general demand, is used as an exchange medium. It serves two purposes. It serves both as a means of payment as well as a measure of value. If you want to see examples of commodity money, we have lots of it. For example, cattle, tobacco, sugar, grains, nails, shells, hides, metals, etc., etc. Lots of examples of commodity money. But a transaction is still essentially a barter trade of one good or services for another good. But obviously, this is better than your barter system. After commodity money, we moved on to the metallic money. Why people started getting interest in metal? Metal became the commodity of choice because they were durable, unlike your perishable food, grains, cattle, etc. They were fungible. They can be easily divided into different denominations, and they can be easily portable. You can carry them wherever you want. I have a famous quote of Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, page 30, which says, "In all countries, however, men seem at last to have been determined by irresistible reasons to give the preference for this employment to metals above every other commodity." Symbolic money, this is what we all know. But let's explore. There are different forms of symbolic money. The simplest form of symbolic money is a warehouse receipt or a claim check for goods on deposit somewhere. Other examples, green bank receipts, vouchers for redemption of various goods that have been deposited, and even currency is redeemable for gold or silver. This is a beautiful pictogram which explains you what exactly a symbolic money means. Let us take a simple example of gold deposited in a bank. The first bank notes were symbolic notes which acknowledged the commodity that is deposited with the bank. It's a symbolic money. They were warehouse receipts for gold, silver placed on deposits. You won't find this in our today's banks. We are talking about the ancient banks. That's what we are going to see shortly. When we see symbolic money, we should surely know who invented it in the world and when did it arrive in India. Paper money was invented in China in the 9th century AD. First used in the West. Understand, it was first used in Asia, not in the West. It was used in the West in the 17th century. Paper money was introduced in India in 1790 by the Bank of Hindustan in Calcutta. Real usage began when the Bank of England began issuing currency notes in 1862. The printing of currency notes in India began for the first time at the government security press in Nasik, Maharashtra in 1928. That was not over. People were not happy even with the metallic money. They wanted something more. Their requirements and needs were increasing day on day. The second evolutionary step came, and from commodity money, people started liking credit money. Again, Hartley Withers in The Meaning of Money, page 18, says, "Some ingenious goldsmith conceived the epoch-making notion of giving notes not only to those who had deposited metals, but to those who came to borrow it, and so founded modern money, modern banking." Please note, "but to those who came to borrow it." Here, in addition to depositing, people also wanted money. They wanted some lender to lend them money, and that's how the borrowing concept started. As of now, we find two types of paper money, the first being the symbolic, wherein people deposited some commodity, and second is the credit money, where some sort of security was created and the banker issued a credit money. Banks issued credit money to indicate money lent on the basis of security. We are going to see again this notion of security, how it has changed from must required to okay, if required, then it's fine. Otherwise, if you are a real entrepreneur, you can repay back. The security requirements can be diluted. The same identical banknotes were issued to represent both symbolic money as well as credit money. But again, there were problems with this credit money also. Banks' notes were often problematic because there were different kinds of paper money, and the bankers started issuing, irrespective of checking whether they have adequate deposits, whether they can have liquid money to repay back to those who have deposited. This came to be known as a fractional reserve, wherein bankers never had enough gold to redeem all the notes, and it started becoming a serious problem. More and more notes were issued, but the liquidity was minimal. The redeemability was hence abandoned because of loss of public confidence, and many of the banks started going bankrupt. Eventually, the redeemability feature was abandoned and symbolic paper money disappeared. Now, virtually all the money circulation is credit money only. Again, people are never satisfied. They want to improvise. That's how, that's what we see in the history of civilization. The third evolutionary step from credit money to clearing money, where people need not require money in their pockets. But what happened was, money took a new shape of keeping score in the economic game of put and take. Money could be exchanged from one bank to the next. What you required was a sort of deposit which can be set off against your buying or selling, or against your promises of payments also. Money and banking have been politicized. As we see, or we will see it shortly, lots of private bankers evolved over a period of time, and everybody started minting or printing their own paper money, because of which lots of bankruptcy also prevailed. And that's why the bank notes were authorized and controlled by national governments only. Governments have generally given the money power to the bankers by establishing the central banks. We are also not going against this philosophy. Hence, we have also established Reserve Bank of India, granting legal standard status to their currencies, and people are legally bound to accept them as money and not as money issued by any other entity. Currency notes issuance in India, Reserve Bank took over the responsibility of note issue and currency note printing after its coming into being in the year 1934. It continued to be empowered with the responsibility of note issue even after the nationalization of Reserve Bank of India in 1949. Everything about Reserve Bank of India we will be covering in a separate chapter of Reserve Bank of India in your Banking Fundamentals book. Now we really start the evolution of the banking. The first reference to banking is found in the 18th century at the time of Hammurabi. Temples were used as banks, and there are records to show the usage of banking terms such as loans, interest, pledges and guarantees, standardizing procedures during the Hammurabi period. But if you see overall, the Assyrians, Babylonians and ancient Greeks practiced simple form of banking like safekeeping, exchanging foreign coins and making loans as early as 2000 BC. Temple was considered to be the safest refuge. People were scared of keeping money in their houses. The best example to take is Egypt and Mesopotamia. Temples were constantly attended with a sacred character. It was a deterrent to thieves. So people were sure that at least the thieves will spare the temple and not do any robbery in the temples. Gold was deposited in the temples for a specific purpose of safekeeping. Robbing in the temple was akin to robbing God. After Mesopotamia, we have varied banking in Greece. It was an improvised version. What happened? Temples such as those in Ephesus and Delphi were banking institutions. But in addition to the temples, private entrepreneurs and public bodies too undertook the banking activities. Deposits were taken as well as loans were given. Money was changed from one currency to another. Coins were tested for weight and purity. As we had seen earlier, even the bones having different shapes and marks were used. But now we started standardizing on the coins based on its weight and purity. Credit for deposits accepted in one city could be arranged in another city by this banking community called moneylenders. But over a period of time, there was a fall in the confidence for banking in the temples. Banking in temples was considered anti-religious. How can you use God for fulfilling your banking needs? People felt temples were unsafe. It was a change of mind. Hence, priests at the temples ceased banking activities. Furthermore, there was a philosopher called Aristotle who totally rejected the practice of interest being charged or interest even given. To an extent, this is a precursor to the Islamic banking. Then we see the strongest period in the European history, the Roman Empire in the 1st century AD. Rome adopted and regularized the banking practice of Greece. They had the power and the breadth of the Roman Empire control the piracy, provided uniform, formalized and predictable legal environment to create utmost confidence in the system. People were very happy during that period in banking. Construction of seaports and shipping infrastructure underwrote the development of trade. So this same money was used in the economy in the form of building ports, infrastructure. People started going from one city to another for trading. What happened in the 2nd century AD? Debt could be officially discharged by paying the amount due into a bank. Public notaries were specifically appointed to register such transaction so that denial of debt payment or issuance could not happen. Rome perfected the administrative aspect of banking even in the 2nd century. Regulations of financial institutions were made for best practices to be adopted. Charging interest on loans and paying interest on deposits became competitive. There was lots of competition happening. But suddenly, banking went into a decline for various causes, such as the death of the Emperor Justinian in 565 AD, collapse of the Roman Empire, hostility of the Christian Church to the charging of interest. Christians were forbidden to lend money to others on interest, as it was considered a sinful act. Every loss has a gain for the other. Similarly, even though Christians were not allowed to do banking, there was a rise of a new community, which were the Jews. The Jews, as they were barred from other forms of employment, became the banker to meet the need to finance growth of Europe. Please note, in spite of the criticism about charging interest on loans by the Jewish holy book, there was an understanding during that period Jews could charge interest on loans to non-Jews. So they may do advance loans to their own Jew community with no interest, but they definitely charge interest to loans to non-Jews. This resulted in their becoming both visible and very rich. Then we see the banking string slowly moving towards Italy. The business skills of the Italians were further enhanced by the invention of double entry bookkeeping. The double entry bookkeeping concept helped bankers to manage their assets as well as liability by proper recording, by giving a double entry effect. Loan was presented as a reward for a risk. rather than as a sin. You show your expertise of collecting deposits from different profiles of customer, deploy their deposits at a profit, and you earn the profit. So there was no form of any sin, and this was possible because of the business skills of the Italians. Italian cities of Florence, Siena, Lucca, Milan, Genoa tremendously profited from banking. Florence was the largest center of banking in Italy. 14th century saw the rise of two big families, the Bardi and the Peruzzi. The Bardis even opened branches outside Florence in London, Bruges, Constantinople, Cyprus, and Jerusalem also. Many of the European kings were in debts to foreign bankers. Today, we see banking is provided to the elite as well as to the masses. But if we see, we are going to see in the second chapter, banking was restricted only to the elite before the nationalization of the banks. Same way, in ancient world, banking was restricted only to the kings. The kings used these bankers for borrowing heavily, and that is how they used to fight wars. Many of the European kings were in debt to Florence bankers, hence Florence was a very powerful city. But suddenly, a big jolt to the Bardi and Peruzzi happened for one specific reason: King Edward III. He was heavily indebted to moneylenders as he had borrowed 6 lakhs gold florins from the Peruzzi and 9 lakh gold florins from the Bardis. In 1340, King Edward III was at war with France, what we call is a 100 years war. And in 1345, King Edward III defaulted in payments. This reduced the two Florentine houses to bankruptcy and almost an end for banking of the Bardi and the Peruzzi. But the Florence was able to survive the disaster, but it took 15 years for the families of Pazzi and Medici to become active financiers once again. The German family called Fuggers ousted the most powerful banking family in Europe, the Medici, which we saw in the last slide, in the 15th century. The Fuggers amassed huge fortunes by managing the finances of princes of Europe and the papacy. Fuggers' wealth was instrumental for the shift of European power to the Habsburg, which is in Germany. So a shift of power from your Florence to Germany. Fuggers took security in the form of, since the loans were given to the kings, interest was not the way of receiving a reward. The reward was received in the form of mining rights. Feudal rights, leases on the sources of royal income, plus they charged heavy interest on loans. What else you require to become powerful and rich? The problem which happened to the Bardis and the Peruzzis also happened with the Fuggers. The Fuggers became too closely aligned with Charles V, who decided to borrow money to wage a series of wars against the Ottomans, French and German Protestants. But in their case, they developed too much exposure to one political figure and gradually moved out of financial risk-taking after some disastrous ventures. They learned an important lesson, which is even followed today, not only by the bankers, but imposed by the central bank, which is diversify both sides of balance sheets. Even today, all the bankers, they don't finance to only one corporate, howsoever big it may be, to one sector, howsoever good it may be. Specific target are put on financing to different corporates based on the percentage of the capital, based on the percentage of the total credit. Now the transformation starts happening. Banking, which was a commercial service only for the kings, was given for the common man also. At this time, moneylenders were called bankers, and in 1565, the London Royal Exchange was established. This started a new concept of a national bank. The initiatives taken by state in establishing banks in Venice, Amsterdam, Habsburg, and Nuremberg, the state started coming up to give protection to the customers, to give protection to their people, and they started banks on their own, and people started getting confidence to get bring in deposits and take loans. And this was specifically demonstrated in Venice, Amsterdam, Habsburg, as well as Nuremberg. And this got a new concept of a national bank wherein the state takes the initiative. But this was formed in the form of partnership with the state. Whichever family wanted to establish a banking business, they started a partnership with the state, and the earliest of such partnership was the Bank of Sweden, established in 1689, which is the oldest surviving bank even today. In 1694, Bank of England was established by arranging a loan of $12 lakhs to the government. People participated in the lucrative East India trade by purchasing bills of credit from these banks. This is how now we are entering into the modern banking. Banking, as we know, began in the 1600s. Banking, we are talking about modern banking. Money changing became the biggest financial activity. We saw the period when money was just accepted as deposits, then slowly it was in the form of loans also. But now money changing became the biggest financial activity in the country and was controlled by the Royal Exchanger on behalf of Crown. In England, the goldsmiths, makers and sellers of plate and jewelry flourished after the dissolution of monasteries in the 1530s. Many goldsmiths developed strong connection with the crown, and from the 1640s, most began to take in valuables for safekeeping in their vaults at the guarded Tower of London. People were willing to deposit gold with them. It was guarded in this very powerful Tower of London. Goldsmith not only took only deposits, but they started to lend money also. City merchants too began keeping the money they did not immediately need with the goldsmiths. Merchants were given a receipt which stated that money would be returned on demand. This is what we call the present day promissory note, as defined in your Negotiable Instruments Act. Goldsmiths began to lend monies in hand which they did not need at the time for interest. The interest being determined on the need for the money and the period it was kept. As demand grew, goldsmiths began to borrow monies to lend. It was not only voluntary tricking of money, but people started coming to them for borrowing. So they required money from the market, they required money from the people. So they also started borrowing money to lend, promising safety and interest. And this is how the British banking was born. Coutts and Company and Child and Company, which originated as goldsmith bankers, continue to operate even today as the nation's oldest surviving banks. Industrial Revolution transformed the nation's economy, and provincial banks began to flourish outside London to serve the industrialists and the merchants. But basically, the British banks were in the form of partnership. And why partnership? Please note, an Act of 1708 had restricted banks with more than six partners from issuing the banknotes. As a result, many of the new banks remained small partnerships to retain the profitable right of note issue well into the 19th century. Their solvency was dependent upon the personal wealth of the partners and the confidence they could command in the local community. Many banks closed during the 19th century when sudden runs, panic cash withdrawals by the nervous customer rendered them insolvent. That is how the formation of joint stock banks came to the picture. The ramifications of the spiraling bank failures forced the governments to permit from 1826 the formation of joint stock companies or joint stock banks, allowing the risk to be spread amongst many proprietors. Lancaster Banking Company became the first British joint stock banks in 1826. Then suddenly there was an outbreak of the First World War. But if you see, the World War took away lives of so many people, but it heralded a period of rapid change in the banking industry. Banks were drawn into funding the government's war loans and advances. Note issue increased rapidly. Bank officers and clerks of military age were enlisted. Temporary junior clerks filled the vacancies. Female staff were also recruited. Before then, only the male staff was recruited for doing the bank's work. But now, there was a shortage of staff. Hence, female staffs are also recruited for banking. Additional branches are opened. Series of amalgamation took place for developing banking business. Second World War, similar problems as seen in 1914-18 during the First World War. Large number of staff joined, even retired employees were recalled. Air raid shelters were hastily built in the head office's basements. Many branch buildings were damaged by bombing. Here, the austerity and government controls were imposed over the foreign exchange and lending priorities, just as we are having heavy controls on forex trading because of the depreciation of the rupee in our current days. After Second World War, austerity and government controls were lifted in the 1950s. During the late 50s and 60s, the banks continued to expand by opening additional branches and offering such new services, new personal loans, based on ability to repay rather than security. Ability to repay rather than security, check guarantee cards, mobile banks, and cash banking machines were installed. New processes like automated check sorting machines were introduced so that the automation and the mechanization of banking came into the Western banking. Employers were encouraged to begin paying wages directly to the bank accounts. Inculcation of savings. The moment your money is in your pocket, the salary is in the pocket, it evaporates. But when it is in the bank, when it is in the bank account, somehow at least something remains. That was the basic idea. Government was also encouraging. In 71, government white paper published a scheme of monetary control which encouraged the banks to compete more actively with one another and with the financial institutions. Banks provided new customer facilities like saving account, credit card, house purchase loan, ATM to sharpen their public image. Many banks embarked on unusual and innovative advertising campaigns, refurbishing and relocating existing branches and opening new accounts. At the same time, expansion requires supervision. There was an increased supervision, and Bank of England had to launch a lifeboat operation supported by the clearing banks. The 1976 Banking Act increased the Bank of England supervision and regulation of the banking system. And that's how we see an evolution of British banking. Now we move on from the Europe to the US. Europe and US banking evolution brings around the total evolution of banking that's happening outside our country. So let's see what United States did for evolution of banking. Bank organizers needed special permission from the state government. Any Tom, Dick, and Harry cannot open a bank unless he got a permission from the state. Additional oversight was provided by the Bank of United States, a central bank founded in 1791. Its organizational chapter expired in 1811, but a second bank was created in 1816 and operated till 1832. After 1832, state government took over supervision. City bankers were extremely cautious about whom to lend and generally made short-term loans, a sort of conservatism. Lending standards were liberal in less settled parts. People wanted to see to whom you are lending, see the repaying capacity. They did not want to go into bankruptcy. After 1860s, US banking saw more than 10,000 different banknotes circulated in their country. Counterfeiting was epidemic. Hundreds of banks failed. Hence, Congress passed the National Currency Act, 1863, for a uniform national currency. 1864, President Lincoln signed a revision of that law, which was called the National Bank Act. New government agency headed by Comptroller of Currency made periodic regulations. This new system worked very well. What did it do? National banks brought US government securities, deposited them with the comptroller, and received the banknotes in return. So notes were printed on the basis of the securities that were deposited. And what was the advantage of this system? If the national bank failed, the government sold the securities and reimbursed the note handholders. National bank's notes were the mainstay of the nation's money supply until the Federal Reserve notes appeared in 1914. By early 1900s, New York was beginning to emerge as a world financial center, and large investments were made by companies in US and Europe. The globalization was started happening in US banking. As you all know, the stock market crash in 1929. It was a global event, and US also had to suffer, and it suffered in the form of a Great Depression. Banks were blamed for Great Depression. More than 1,000 US banks failed in 1931. Scenes of panic throughout the country. But again, there were prominent results that followed in the form of these three important activities. The first one was the Banking Act of 1933. It provided a system, which we also did it in our country. We'll go through it in the second chapter. Banking was limited to the local markets only. The globalization was limited. Rising importance of government in financial matters, very little for banks to do till the early 1960s. Total governing by the government. But what happens after 1960s is very interesting. The same thing happened in our country in the 1990s. 1970s saw policies in place following the Depression. It resulted in deregulation and privatization of government-owned enterprise in the 1980s. Government of industrial countries around the world found private sector solutions to problems of economic growth and development. People required efficiency, people required good bottom lines, and people felt privatization was the answer. Large companies became global and dealt with customers, suppliers, manufacturers, and information centers all over the world. There was a proliferation of global banking. Global banking and capital market services proliferated during the 1980s and 1990s. Interest rates in US declined from 15% to 5%. Even now, if you see the European rates, they are very much lesser than what is prevailing in your country, both your asset side as well as your liability side. Financial assets grew at a rate approximately twice the rate of world economy. Internationalization of financial markets. Japan provided funds to corporations and federal governments in the US. US stock markets transformed into largest in the world. There was a preference for universal banking. Extraordinary growth of foreign financial markets, increase in pool of savings in foreign countries, deregulation of foreign financial markets enabled expansion of activities. American corporations and bankers started seeking investment opportunities abroad. Mutual funds specializing in trading in foreign stock markets were developed. Universal banking adopted by the US. Banks were free to engage as one-stop supplier of both retail and wholesale financial services. There was no compartmentalization. Everything and anything you wanted was provided under one roof. By the end of 2000, the top 10 banks commanded a market share of more than 80%. Out of the top 10, 7 were large universal type banks and the remaining 3 were large investment banks. Large corporate players were beginning to find their way into financial services community, which are non-banking companies, offering competition to these established banks. Main services offered included insurance, pension, mutual funds, money market and hedge funds, loans, credits and securities, and merchant banking as well. This growth and opportunity led to the financial service community offering competition to the established banks. From the last quarter of the 20th century, banking has undergone a tremendous change because of one-on-one technology revolution. Telephone banking, debit and credit cards, automated teller machines, internet banking, mobile banking are commonplace. And what is awaited and what is going to come now is electronic money and digital banking, which is still in the evolution stage, and we are going to see lots more over a period of time. Thank you. That's the end of chapter 1. We'll begin our chapter 2 in our next session.